Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Imbalance of power. The week started with the prospect of a new political landscape in Haiti, but the threat of more violence has Canada pulling some of its diplomatic staff out of Port-au-Prince, and our guest says the gangs are very clearly still in charge.
Report, retort. Just weeks after Alberta put new restrictions on wind and solar development, a new report out today undermines the government's reasoning.
The cons of the long con. Police in the Philippines rescue hundreds of desperate workers forced to carry out text scams against North Americans. Our guest says thousands of other people are trapped in the same situation.
Military imprecision. The Office of Canada's Chief of Defence Staff demands reporters file an access to information request for a transcript of a recent speech, even though you can watch a video of that speech at your leisure.
Appearances can be deceiving. You might think mother chimps are all business when food is getting scarce. They've got things to do, but new research suggests they still make time to play with their young.
Nice work on ape appearances. And working the room imminence. A blizzard forced two road-tripping dairy farmers to stop at a farm supply store to seek help milking their 50 uncomfortable goats. An employee tells us why she and dozens of others lent a hopefully warm hand. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that's glad they stayed together for the kids. Haiti's prime minister is set to resign, and a presidential transitional council is in the works, which marked the end of one chapter in the story of the power struggle in Haiti, but another is just beginning. That council, backed by Caribbean leaders, was proposed in Jamaica earlier this week. But since then, several high-profile politicians have refused to take part. Others suggest the gang leaders may have political ambitions themselves. Meanwhile, the country is still facing violence and humanitarian crises. Today, Canada evacuated a portion of its embassy staff from Port-au-Prince. Robert Fatton is a Haitian-born professor of political science at the University of Virginia. We reached him in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Professor Fatton, Canada's UN Ambassador Bob Rae was on our program on Tuesday. He said this transitional council could be up and running within days. How long do you think it will take?
Well, I assume that it will be a matter of days, although there are problems within the presidential college, because one of the key parties has decided not to be part of it. And this is the party of Petite Dessalines, which is led by someone called Moïse Jean-Charles. And Moïse Jean-Charles has decided that he would join forces with an alternative presidential council, which it would be headed to a large degree by Guy Philippe, someone who just was released from American jail and is now in Haiti, yeah, presenting himself as a revolutionary.
So already it's crumbling before it even got off the ground. Moïse Jean-Charles, who you just mentioned, is a former senator and presidential candidate. He says the proposal negotiated in Jamaica for this transitional council is not a Haitian-led solution. Others obviously feel differently. But just how much power do Guy Philippe and Moïse Jean-Charles have? Is anyone going to listen to them?
Well, it's not very clear, but Moïse Jean-Charles has a popular following, and it looks like Guy Philippe has one also. But there may well be an official kind of agreement between Guy Philippe and the armed men, insofar as Guy Philippe has promised that if his presidential college becomes the new government of Haiti, well, that the gangs will silence their weapons. So without some sort of agreement, it's difficult to see how you're going to have a new government, let alone one that is installed in Port-au-Prince.
And they have so much power. Why would they give it up? What's going to be the incentive or concessions?
Well, Yeah, there are no concessions so far, at least visibly. Yeah, there might be secret talks with the armed men, but that's not clear. One of the issues in the Jamaican dispensation is that no one who was convicted of criminal activities, etc., could be part of the new presidential council. But you have a big problem because many of the old politicians who are part of some of the parties to the Jamaican dispensation have a very iffy past, and some of them were actually sanctioned. So it's a complicated situation. But one can assume that whether it's going to be six, whether it's going to be nine, whether it's going to be five parties, may ultimately have some sort of coalition and may ultimately be able to be installed as the new government. Mm-hmm. But they will have to deal with the gangs, and that is not a very easy thing to wish away.
The capital is still very volatile, as our listeners have heard. Gang leader Jimmy Cherizier has put out a video, and he's angry at the politicians and seems to be threatening the families. I don't know if your kids are in Haiti, if your wives are in Haiti, if your husbands are in Haiti, if you're going around the country, all your family ought to be there. So talking about Cherizier in particular, you know, on one hand, the alliance of this gang is called Living Together. He describes himself as a community leader, but he's not called barbecue because he likes parties in his backyard, right? So what do you think the ultimate goal of Cherizier and the other gang leaders is?
Well, it's not clear. Cherizier likes to portray himself as the savior of Haiti. He's kind of the embodiment of Martin Luther King, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Malcolm X, etc. So he has a revolutionary rhetoric. But on the other hand, his record is one of violence. And the people who support Cherizier are supporting him to a large degree because he's a violent man. And the people who have suffered the consequences of that are not really the wealthy people in Port-au-Prince. They are, to a large degree, they're very poor. So Cherizier is probably not the solution, to put it mildly. But he has the weapons, and you can't ignore him. So whether there are secret negotiations with Barbecue about some sort of amnesty, or whether there is negotiations with Barbecue remains to be seen. But as the situation deteriorates and the political class can't come to an agreement, then it may well be that the population will be compelled to go ahead and accept that those with the guns are going to run the show, and that might create some sort of stable environment. But that's unlikely too, because mm-hmm. it's difficult to see a government led by gang leaders.
There are so many competing voices and people, as you said, Haitians stuck in the middle of all of this. How do you see this developing in the next few days?
Well, the future of Haiti, in my view, and it's very depressing to say so, is very bleak. Because even if you were able to see the dispensation of Jamaica materialize, what kind of government can organize some sort of election, can establish some sort of peace? I don't see it, unfortunately, as an easy process. We've had many opportunities in the past, many crises, opportunities to hope for a better future, and yet nothing has happened. If anything, the situation has deteriorated significantly because the gangs now are much more powerful, and they are capable of becoming the arbiter of the immediate future of Haiti, which is a rather depressing idea. But it's one that we have to entertain, given mm-hmm. the constellation of power in Haiti itself.
Professor, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Robert Fatin is a Haitian-born professor of political science at the University of Virginia. We reached him in Charlottesville, Virginia. It starts with a mysterious text message, the kind you might have received yourself. It might say something like, "Hi, don't you remember me?" And what follows is an elaborate scam in which, after weeks or months of texting, the scammer tries to rope you into buying cryptocurrency and steals your money. But it turns out that the scammer on the other side of that text is also being taken advantage of. Today, authorities in the Philippines announced the rescue of hundreds of people at a scam call center north of Manila who were being held and forced to commit the scams against their will. Zeke Fox is a reporter and author of the crypto expose Number Go Up. For that book, he investigated these Southeast Asian call centers and talked to people who had escaped. We reached him in New York.
Zeke, what is life like inside these cell compounds?
So I've spoken with quite a few people who have escaped from scam compounds in Cambodia by paying ransom. Mm-hmm. What they've told me is that they're lured there with fake job offers. Say, hey, high-paying job in customer service, you make $1,000 a month. Once they show up, they're trapped, their passports are taken, they're not allowed to leave, they're forced to sit on computers and phones and send these fake messages all day trying to trick people. And if they don't hit quotas, they can face beatings or even torture like electric shocks. And workers have said that if they don't do well, they're sometimes sold to other compounds.
In this case, hundreds of people were rescued from a compound in the Philippines. You, as you mentioned, spoke to people from Cambodia. Is there a particular story that stays with you?
There was one Vietnamese man named Thuy who I interviewed for my book, Number Go Up. Mm-hmm. He told me that he'd been lured to a compound called Chinatown in Cambodia. And the beatings that he faced there were really brutal. He had given up on any hope of getting out alive until he was able to steal a phone and contact a Vietnamese YouTuber who ended up paying his ransom. Mm-hmm. The workers I talked to are terrified. And the scale of this problem is really unbelievable. The UN estimates that there are more than 200,000 people trapped in scam compounds, mostly in Southeast Asia.
And we've heard, I think, a lot about the second part of this scam, the people who, you know, are tricked into handing over money or Bitcoin. But we haven't heard as much about this part of the story. The scam itself is called pig butchering because, you know, it's akin to fattening up a mark, working their confidence, getting them on side before they steal from them. So just step by step, how do they reach out to people and lure them in?
So I played along with one once to see how it works, mm-hmm. and what happened to me was pretty typical. The person approached me with a spam text message that said, "Hey, David, you know, how's it going?" And when I said I thought they had the wrong number, they said, "How about we be friends?" And they said their name was Vicky Ho, and they started sending me pictures of themselves, and they appeared to be a attractive young Asian woman. Mm-hmm. And for days, they chatted me up and tried to kind of make friends while dropping hints that they were rich and that they had gotten it because they knew tricks about cryptocurrency trading. Eventually, they moved in for the kill. They told me to download a special crypto trading app and that I could transfer money to it just by depositing money at a regular crypto app and sending it to their address. And once you zap the money over to their crypto trading app, mm-hmm. it's as good as gone. But you can open the app and it looks like you're making money there. That's sort of the fattening up part. Mm. They say they'll sometimes let victims even make small withdrawals, but the whole time they're making friends with you, they're sizing you up and trying to figure out how much they can take you for. Mm. And once they get you to send in a significant amount, then they disappear with whatever they can get. And I've talked with financial victims who've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars, even millions of dollars.
And we should mention our colleagues at CBC's Go Public consumer investigative reporting team. They looked into a similar scam and as you did, played along with it to see how it goes. And really, I think First of all, it's remarkable when you are able to speak with people because so many people feel shame, especially if they've lost a lot of money and don't come forward. But that's the thing. It can happen to anyone.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I've spoken to people who had, you know, graduate degrees who fell for this. You know, in hindsight, you're like, how did they find this convincing? Yeah. But the people who fall for it are often someone who is at, you know, a bad time in their life. They've had some sort of tragedy occur to them, or like a divorce or a bad medical diagnosis. And that's the pattern that I see, that those are the kind of people who are mm-hmm. more susceptible to this.
Who is benefiting? Who is at the top of this? Who are the bosses here? Because it's not the people in the compounds, as we've said, and certainly not the people on the other end of the line.
It's hard to know who's running each particular scam, but reporters around the world have been looking into who owns the real estate where these compounds mm-hmm. are based. And in some cases, they've linked it to Chinese organized crime figures. One of the biggest compounds is in Myanmar, and it's reportedly controlled by a Chinese gangster who goes by the nickname Broken Tooth.
One thing I wanted to go back to, you know, you're talking about the people in the cells being forced to work all day, meet quotas. The ones you spoke with, what did they tell you about how they feel knowing what they're doing to other people, but having no choice, it appears?
They, in general, said that they felt terrible about it. And some of the people I spoke to said that they were basically unwilling to do it and faced punishment because of that. I've seen stories of other escapees who, you know, who also, they all feel, have said that they feel really bad, but the punishments that they face for not hitting their quotas are really terrible. So they're put in a desperate situation.
Zeke, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Zeke Fox is a reporter and the author of the book Number Go Up: Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. We reached him in New York. We've all been there, hours into a long car ride with hours more to go. Severe boredom sets in, your back is aching, and your udder is really getting uncomfortably swollen. Dairy farmers Jose and Bartolo Garcia were hauling a load of 50 goats from Minnesota to their farm in California when they hit a huge snowstorm in Utah. They'd already been driving for around 12 hours, and they realized the goats were going to have to be milked to prevent discomfort and possible infection. So they found themselves in the parking lot of a livestock supply store where they asked the staff for some help with the milking. They got it and more. Lisa Fernandez was getting ready to close the store when she agreed to give milking a goat a try. We reached her in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Lisa, why did you say yes to milking these goats?
Mostly because I didn't want them to have to do it all themselves. And it was a new adventure for me, something new to try. So I offered to help.
How did you get wind of that there was this situation unfolding that they needed to... They needed to milk these goats because it had been 12 hours exactly. They're full, probably in pain, and it could lead to infection. So how did you find out?
So he had called about an hour before they showed up at the store, so about 6:30, 6:45 or mm-hmm. so, asking if we had any hay available, then told me a little bit about the story, how they were being rerouted through Salt Lake City. And then about 7:45 that night, they showed up at the store, and they told me a little bit more about it, a little bit more details, that they were picking up their goats in Minnesota, headed back to California, back home to California, and they had 50 goats in their trailer and 25 kids, which are the baby goats, mm-hmm. and they asked if they could stay in the parking lot until they got all their goats milked. And then he nonchalantly asked me, hey, you want to help? And he's like, have you ever milked a goat before? And I said, actually, no, I haven't. Yeah. But I wouldn't mind learning. He's like, yeah, I can show you. I said, so let me close up the store. Yeah. You know, we close at 8. So let me close up the store and then I'll come out and I'll help you. Well, then there was another, he said, is there anyone else that would like to help or learn how to milk? So I called one more team member that I had there with me. She had volunteered at a horse and goat rescue. So I asked her if she had ever milked a goat and if she wanted to help. And she volunteered right away. Oh, yeah, I would love to. So we closed up the store, went out.
And then there were it wasn't just the two of you.
Well, it was at first. It was him and his uncle. And then it was myself and my team member. And I called the store manager since it was, you know, after closing. I know that the sheriff's department would patrol the area because of where we are. And I didn't want her to get worried and think something was going on at the store. So I called the store manager and let her know, hey, we're out here helping these gentlemen milk their goats. We're going to be a
just
while.
Normal, you know, just a normal, you know, after after closing conversation. Yeah. Have you milked a goat? And do you want to join us? These are not questions you expect to hear, you know, on a random day.
No, not at all. No.
So how many people came out in the end?
Altogether, there were about, I want to say about 40 people altogether. Okay, that included some kids that came out with their parents.
Sure, yeah.
They wanted to see right the goats. There. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they did, too. They kept the goats calm and petted them and fed them. And so there's a lot of people.
You got a crash course, as you said, in how to milk a goat 101.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what are the top tips?
Top tips is do not yank.
Yeah.
It's not going to help them and it's going to hurt them. Just stay calm. Get a steady pace. Use your index finger and your thumb to start at the top and trap the milk in the udder and then just squeeze down with the other fingers.
How many did you end up milking?
Me personally, I did about four.
Yeah. You're a pro now then.
I am a pro. I can definitely say I've done it and I can do it again.
Are you getting more calls now? Are you worried that this is going to be a side project?
I have not, but a lot of people come in and say, hey, if you ever want to come see my goats.
We're short a couple of hands. You guys got some treats sort of at the end. I saw people, you know, taking some milk home.
Yes. Yeah, so we ended up bringing, we had some cups in the store. So I ended up bringing some out because he was offering anyone that wants to take some milk, take it. We're just getting rid of it. So brought some cups out for everyone, and they had jars of their own and their like mason jars in their trucks. So anyone that wanted some could take some and try it.
And did you?
I did not personally, no. I was so wrapped up in making sure everything was handled and everyone had what they needed that I just never got to try it.
They must have been... I mean, the goats must have been grateful. I don't know how they vocalized to you. how were they feeling and acting afterwards?
You could tell their mannerism. When they got out, they were almost waddling because they were so full and they were anxious. I mean,
can we all relate? Yeah.
Yeah, long exactly.
Road trips? Yeah.
Exactly, yes. So once we had them milked, you could tell how relaxed they were and they were like wanting pets from everyone. And yeah, they were definitely happier.
And what about the Garcias? How did they react to all of the help?
So they were brought to tears.
Really?
They thanked every single person. Oh. Yeah, they could not believe the outcome and the outpour of help that they received. Yeah. Everyone just walked up and first thing was, what can we do to help? Where do you need us? It was amazing.
Well, even as you were telling the story of how everything unfolded, you know, you know that the local police patrol, so you wanted to make sure everybody knew what was going on. You called your manager. I mean, that's already – Salt Lake City isn't – or even Stansbury Park is not that small, right? But there is clearly that sense of community.
Yes, definitely. Stansbury Park is a smaller community, outskirts of Salt Lake City. But you can definitely tell everyone is there for everyone wherever you need them, whatever you need. They're going to be there.
Everyone and their goats.
Yes, exactly.
Clearly, this is a great story that, you know, we're happy that you're telling us and you'll tell for a long time to come, as you should.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so will others. But is there something bigger you're taking away from it as well?
You know, I'm from California and all the hustle and bustle of California, everyone's just in a hurry for everything and about themselves. But being here in Utah and Stansbury Park and Salt Lake City, just the sense of community. And like it definitely restored my faith in people and humanity and a strong community. I am so grateful to be a part of it all.
A pleasure speaking with you, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa Fernandez is the assistant manager at Tractor Supply Company. We reached her in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Prolonged campaigns of disinformation and misinformation are profoundly threatening, interfering with our political processes, sowing discord, heating up political divisions, and undermining confidence in our democratic institutions and democracy itself.
That is General Wayne Eyre, Canada's Chief of Defence Staff, addressing a conference in Ottawa last week in a speech that you are not allowed to see. Wait, hold on. I'm so sorry. Of course you can see it. It's a speech by the Chief of Defence Staff. It's important for you to know what he's thinking. That's why there's a video online. That's where we got the audio from. And it's where we got this audio from.
What we need is a wider national security dialogue across the country to raise our collective appreciation of the true long-term threats and to do something about them. Because we don't pretend to have all the answers. And that's why that dialogue is so important, to increase the richness of the menu of solutions to address many of the problems that are out there.
He even talked about the importance of dialogues. Obviously, you're allowed to see it. That's just embarrassing. The management regrets the error, you know. Anyway, no, what it is you're not allowed to read it. Wait, no, sorry, is that right? I'm all turned around here. Just a second. Okay, right. So the Ottawa Citizen has reported that it contacted the office of the Chief of Defence Staff requesting a transcript of that speech, and that the office told the Citizen that if it wanted a written copy of the speech from last week, it would have to submit an access to information request, which could take up to 2 years to process. Did the General write it out longhand on non-faxable parchment? Because if not, why doesn't his office just, you know, search for cool speech, final in his documents and email it? You know, I'm sure there's a good explanation. No, says here his office, could not provide an explanation. So you can hear General Eyre saying the words in that video whenever you want, but his office won't send you those exact same words typed out. That seems inefficient and not really in the spirit of dialogue, which I thought was the general idea.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
When Alberta lifted its moratorium on new wind and solar developments last month, it also instituted new restrictions on such projects, ostensibly to protect prime farmland and what the province referred to as pristine viewscapes. But now a new report by the Alberta Utilities Commission says wind and solar developments present little threat to agriculture or the environment in the province, and it was commissioned by Premier Danielle Smith's government. Martin Olshinsky is an environment and natural resource law professor at the University of Calgary. We reached him in Calgary.
Martin, what's the message do you think this report sends to Premier Smith and her government?
Well, you know, in a sense, actually, the message is to Albertans, because the Premier actually and her government have had this report mm-hmm. since January 31st of this year. So a full month before they ended the moratorium on renewable energy development and announced a suite of policies. And so really what the report does is it allows Albertans to be able to gauge better the basis for those policies and whether or not they make any sense.
You described it as a wrecking ball to those policies.
That's right.
Why?
Yeah. When you read this report, what you see is a fact-based and evidence-based sort of assessment of the issues. And the AUC is clear that, you know, for instance, they say, the regulatory framework that protects environmental land against the impacts of wind and solar generation is generally robust and, in fact, more comprehensive than the regulatory framework governing other forms of industrial development. They talk about agricultural land and point out that, you know, for the most part, market forces have favored non-prime agricultural land for renewable projects. And so, you know, when we think about every talking point and sort of like general position of the province that renewables need to be restricted from prime agricultural land, or that they're going to interfere, or that reclamation is like this big problem. You know, here we have a fact-based, evidence-based sort of assessment of those things, and it turns out that none of those things are actually true.
On the issue of timing, and other critics of the government's policies on this, including the environment critic for the opposition NDP in Alberta, have been asking about the timing. Why do you think the government put out the new restrictions that it did when it had this report?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some respects it was some of those policies were a foregone conclusion. You know, and so. You know, I think it's very clear that there is a faction of the UCP base in rural Alberta that has very strong feelings about renewables. But at the same time, I think that both the Premier and Minister Neudorf didn't want to be asked difficult questions when they announced those policies.
But the government knew that this report was going to come out eventually. They commissioned it. There's another one coming as well. So what do you make of all of that? How do you see them responding to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is it's the nature of our political culture and the news cycle. I think that, you know, to some extent, you know, and actually, I guess I do have to throw them, you know, some credit that they even had this inquiry. Because, you know, on the one hand, of course, we've been asking for similar inquiries in the context of oil and gas, for instance, mm-hmm. to no avail. We've had, the problems there are exponentially worse, and we've never gotten an inquiry. And so in some respects, a lot of people felt like the inquiry was a form of punishment. So, yeah, so to some extent, I do actually probably have to say to the government that at least they have released them. They have released these reports and they can be held accountable. But of course, the news cycle, the timing cycle, the investment cycle, you know, I guess in a sense, I think a lot of the damage has already been done. And now, you know, whether or not this report allows for cooler heads to prevail, whether in working out, because the February 29th press conference mm-hmm. and the policies they announced then were super vague and need a ton of work in fleshing them out. So maybe there's like some basis now for optimism that as stakeholders work with the AUC and yeah. the government to sort of flesh out these policies, maybe cooler heads will prevail.
Provinces are always looking to attract investment. Why do you think the government would do something that puts that at risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, I think what people have to understand, and maybe Canadians more generally, is that like Alberta is a very strange place right now. This is a battle, frankly, in lots of ways, I think we understand this is a fight between sort of incumbents, and in Alberta, that really means the fossil fuel industry, oil and gas, you know, and the incredible power that they have and exert over our political culture and also our government, versus sort of emerging industries and that threaten to disrupt those incumbent interests. And so while we would like to have a neutral government, a government that's agnostic about the forms of energy development, for instance, and encourages all kinds of investment and a diversification and a moving away, for instance, from fossil fuels in light of climate policies, not just in Canada, but actually, in fact, more importantly, around the world, mm-hmm. We're seeing the opposite.
But a government's responsibility is also to regulate and make sure industries are operating as they should. So even if this is a lucrative industry, an important one, as we look at the impacts of climate change and one that a lot of people are looking to and like, it still needs to be regulated. So how do you square that with your concerns about what's been done already?
Yeah, here's your independent regulator saying that for the most part, you know, yes, we can make some tweaks here. We can provide more a greater role for municipalities in these decisions. We can work on, you know, some of the assessments that we do on a case by case basis, for instance, with regard to viewscapes. But they, you know, the general thrust of this report is, we got this.
You don't see what the government's doing. You don't see what the government's doing as regulation.
No, of course. And I mean, all you have to do is look at the oil and gas sector as the contrast, right? So here we have suddenly the government rolling out, talking about reclamation security for the renewable sector, when we know that the oil and gas sector's liabilities are hundreds of times greater. And we don't have an inquiry into oil and gas liabilities. We don't have a moratorium on oil and gas development. So, you know, I think when we're talking about the bona fides of the government's, you know, the genuine sort of like motivations of our government here, it's essentially just like, I think it's untenable to suggest that this is genuinely about orderly development when there's such a chasm between what the regulator says would be required for that orderly development and what the province has sort of announced, and then the contrast that mm-hmm. with these other sectors and the sort of free ride that they've been getting for the past 30, 40 years.
Martin, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Martin Olshinsky is a professor at the University of Calgary. We contacted the Alberta government for comment, but we did not hear back before airtime. Earlier this week, Donald Trump and Joe Biden officially clinched their party's nominations for president. So for the next 10 months, you can expect plenty of coverage of those campaigns. But that's not the election Chuck Schumer wants to talk about. Mr. Schumer is a Democrat and the Senate Majority Leader. He's also the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the country. And today he had sharp words for another elected official, Benjamin Netanyahu. In a speech, Mr. Schumer condemned Hamas and the October 7th attacks, but he said he believes Israel's current coalition government no longer fits the country's needs.
5 months into this conflict, it is clear that Israelis need to take stock of the situation and ask, must we change course? At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel. At a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government. I also believe a majority of the Israeli public will recognize the need for change, and I believe that holding a new election, once the war starts to wind down, would give Israelis an opportunity to express their vision for the post-war future. Of course, the United States cannot dictate the outcome of an election, nor should we try. As a democracy, Israel has the right to choose its own leaders, and we should let the chips fall where they may. But the important thing is that Israelis are given a choice. There needs to be a fresh debate about the future of Israel after October 7th. In my opinion, that is best accomplished by holding an election.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Mitch McConnell is the Senate GOP leader. Here's how he responded.
People of Israel, at home and in captivity, deserve America's support. And Israel's unity government and security cabinet deserve the deference befitting a sovereign democratic country. It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel. This is unprecedented. We should not treat fellow democracies this way at all. Israel is not a colony of America whose leaders serve at the pleasure of the party in power in Washington. Only Israel's citizens should have a say in who runs their government. This is the very definition of democracy and sovereignty. Either we respect their decisions or we disrespect their democracy.
Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell responding to Chuck Schumer's calls for a new election in Israel. Last week, the RCMP in Prince George, BC, issued a press release announcing the seizure of prescription drugs, some of which, the police said, came from British Columbia's Safe Supply Program. That immediately became a talking point for conservative leaders, including Pierre Poilievre, who renewed their criticism of that program. But the RCMP later retracted their statement, saying there was no evidence to suggest the drugs seized had originated in the government's harm reduction program. The CBC's Stephen Quinn spoke with British Columbia's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, Jennifer Whiteside.
Yeah, that was a bit puzzling and, you know, sort of unusual to speak to the origins of medications before there's before there's more, you know, consideration of the local situation. And I guess I would just say that we work very closely with law enforcement on a number of programs, and the consistent message that we have received from both the RCMP and from municipal forces is that their primary concern is the illicit trade in fentanyl, because frankly that is what is killing British Columbians in such large numbers. So that is that's what generally their primary concern is.
Dr. Bonnie Henry's report on the Safer Supply program last month said this, and this is a quote, "Some diversion is occurring. However, the extent and impacts are unknown. Diversion to people at risk of drug poisoning may be of benefit, while diversion to people who would otherwise not use unregulated drugs is harmful." Public Safety Minister Mike Farnworth said earlier this week that there is no evidence of widespread diversion of drugs. So what's he basing that on if public health hasn't been able to determine the full extent of the diversion?
Well, Minister Farnworth is basing his comments on a subsequent press release that was issued by the senior levels of the RCMP in the province late last week, confirming that that there is no evidence of widespread diversion prescribed medications that originate in the province's pharmaceutical alternatives program. Now, that is not to say that people do not misuse their prescriptions. Nobody is really suggesting that doesn't happen from time to time, and I think it may well be that that local RCMP detachments may be seeing some of that in and amongst what they they seize when they are doing their work going after predatory drug dealers and traffickers who prey on vulnerable people. But we're not seeing, no one has been able to identify, and frankly, the numbers just don't support a massive, what some folks have called a flooding of the streets of these medications. The numbers of people on this program are very small.
BC's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, Jennifer Whiteside, talking to Stephen Quinn, host of the Early Edition in Vancouver. You're tired. You have a project to finish. There's a new RuPaul's Drag Race. There are a lot of reasons parents might find it hard to make time to play with our kids. But apparently, chimpanzees make no such excuses. New research suggests that even when food is scarce, mother chimps find time to play with their young, which shows just how important play is in their development. Zareen Machanda is an assistant professor at Tufts University and a lead researcher on the project. We reached her in Boston.
Zareen, take us back into the field with you, if you could. How do these chimps play?
Chimps play all the time, especially mm-hmm. if you're watching baby chimps. Just if you were watching baby humans, it's kind of part of their day-to-day behavioral repertoire. Mm-hmm. What's less common is actually when adults play. So, you know, when you're out with the chimps, it's kind of fun to see two big male chimps or two adult chimps kind of start to chase each other and... chimps actually have a very particular facial expression they make when they play, so it's really obvious that they're playing. And they also, they do laugh, so, you know, it's just kind of one of those things that just makes you happy to see. No matter what your mood is when the chimps start playing, it puts you in a good mood.
And what kinds of things were the mother and baby chimps doing?
All chimps play in kind of characteristic ways. They chase each other, they tickle, they wrestle. They'll do somersaults and they'll, you know, play bite and play hit. with moms and babies, you know, those are the same kinds of things that we might see, a lot of tickling, a lot of wrestling. But the other thing that you see with moms and really small babies is that they play the airplane game, which is just this really cute, you know, the moms go down on their back and they hold their babies up in the air and swing them around. And
I can see, I'm smiling hearing you describe it, so I can only imagine what it's like. I have seen some of the video that you and your team released as well, but I hear what you're saying about how much joy it brings just to watch it, let alone for those who are actually playing. You and your colleagues have been observing chimps for a really long time. You already knew chimps were playful, but what surprised you this time?
You know, what was interesting is kind of recently, we've noticed that some years in the kind of more recent past, like 2016, 2017, we had really, really good food everywhere. You know, it was just one of those kind of things that comes and goes, but 2017, we just had amazing amounts of food in the forest. And it was in that year that we were out with the chimps and we noticed that they were playing a lot. And it wasn't, you know, just the babies playing, it was the adults playing with each other. And we started to put together that connection of, you know, does this have something to do with the fact that there's a lot of food available? And we know that other chimp behaviors do change or kind of decrease when less food is available. So it wasn't, you know, we were basing the idea that maybe play is this extra behavior that they do when food is good based on some other, you know, some other behaviors. So we started to look at it and found, you know, this very nice relationship that when they have more food, they're more likely to play. But what was interesting is when you look at any chimp study, it's really common to think about how males and females behave differently. And especially when it relates to food, we know that females care more about food because their reproduction is much more energetically costly. You know, it costs a lot of calories to produce milk for their babies. And so we looked at that sex difference between males and females, and we expected that the females would actually kind of stop playing even more so than the males because they should care more about the fact that there is less food available. And we didn't find it. And that was, you know, I always kind of say that, you know, the magic of science happens when you get these unexpected things, you know, and we've been following chimps for so long that this really was a pretty unexpected result.
You didn't expect to be surprised.
No, I really didn't. I mean, it doesn't happen, you know, I mean, I feel like we have really good intuition about our chimps and their behavior and what to expect. And then when you find something that totally is in complete opposite of what you expect to find, you really, you know, really kind of gets you curious about the world. And, you know, after 20 plus years, it's fun to be surprised by something, right?
So you saw that they were playing despite the food scarcity.
Yeah.
Why ultimately do you think the mothers were still doing that?
This kind of behavior, this play behavior, is so developmentally important in the lives of those young chimps that mothers have to keep doing it, you know, that mothers have to be that play partner. And the thing about chimps is when food is poor, females tend to kind of separate and they don't want to compete with other chimps. So they tend to be alone with their babies. And so in many ways, this is the obligation of being a chimp mom, that you may be the only play partner for your baby. And this is such an important thing to do that you have to take that cost, even when other chimps would stop doing it.
Do you think they might be getting some enjoyment from it too, the mothers, I mean, or do you think it is a sacrifice?
I mean, I think it's from an evolutionary point of view, it's a cost, right? That they're not feeding, they're not spending that time feeding, they might be expending more calories. You know, are they enjoying it? You know, they certainly have their play face on when they're playing with their babies. But, you know, sometimes you see, you know, I mean, I think a lot of human parents will relate to this. You know, sometimes the moms are resting on the ground, trying to sleep or just shut their eyes, and then their baby's bouncing on top of them, and they're like, you know, using their arm to play with their babies when you can, you know, I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing, but like the facial expression is, please just let me take a nap. One of the videos that we shared is this mom playing and wrestling with her, you know, 5-year-old baby as she's simultaneously nursing her, you know, like 1-year-old infant. And I think a lot of parents can really kind of resonate with that image of this mom who is juggling, you know, all of these duties of motherhood simultaneously.
You felt a connection there, it sounds like, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, sometimes you see these mom chimps and you're like, I feel it. I get it.
Do you think the chimps will surprise you again?
I know the chimps will surprise me again. I mean, I think this is probably true for almost any wildlife biologist, but, you know, I think with chimps especially, since they're such weirdly wonderful, complicated, complex animals, there has not been a single day that I have been out with a chimp, you know, and we're talking, you know, 500 plus, you know, maybe 1,000 days in the forest with these animals, that they haven't done something surprising.
Zareen, I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.
Zareen Machanda is an assistant professor at Tufts University. We reached her in Lexington, Massachusetts. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.